And that's right. We are back once again. It is the 116th. they just keep stacking up, don't they? This is the 116th installment of The Parish of the Patriots, if you can believe that. It is an amazing thing. I'm really glad you stopped by. Hopefully you'll enjoy this week's show. If you're new around here, we do have a discussion. We just kind of discuss whatever the hell I feel like talking about. And then later on, we have a Christian-specific message, usually pretty much the second half of the show. A sermon, if you would. So you'll get something out of that, hopefully. Like I say, I even have people that say they're not Christians and they get something out of it. So I don't know. There must be something there. I think you'll get, you know, if you just like you're new here and you're like, well, I ain't going to listen to that. I ain't going to listen to no jive ass preacher talking about Jesus. it's not like your normal cuck church. You'll probably get something out of it. But anyway, glad you stopped by. This show is supported by you, the listeners. That's right. Don't be shy. Pay those tithes. I do appreciate the financial support. We got snail mail. We got Bitcoin. We got a Monero address. All that information's at the bottom of the description page. I do appreciate it. If you have some other weirdo cryptocurrency, drop me an email. I'll do my best to get you an address for that. And if you do, drop me an email. I do enjoy sharing the listener supporter mailbag. Speaking of which, we're going to get right off into the listener supporter mailbag. Dear Grandpa, hope that all's good in the Lone Star State. Thanks for all the good work and good counsel, Nick. Well, I do appreciate it. And it's kind of soggy. It's kind of been soggy here in the Lone Star State. This is our soggy time before we get into the blistering heat time, which will be before we know it. Mr. T, GPD, greetings from Clown World, Hong Kong. Yes, and the clownishness continues. It's except that clowns are supposed to be kind of funny, and this is just kind of funny strange, not really funny, ha-ha. We have a senile dementia president who's obviously just acting as a puppet. While clamping down domestically, they're also agitating war with Russia and China. It's just so absurd. Yeah, the ride just never ends. Speaking of which, speaking of the dementia president, he apparently gave an address. I didn't watch it. Apparently not hardly anybody did. But as most of you did, you know, read some of the hot takes from it. I'm sure glad I can't tell how relieved I am that he made it a point to point out that the number one terrorist threat are white supremacists, which, you know, unless you're living under a rock, you know, that basically just means white people. Any white people that don't agree with the oligarchy, with him, you are a white supremacist. We have to make that clear, you know, because they don't ever define these terms because, you know, people might hesitate a little bit if they actually said, well, and they should. Somebody should, if you could, like, sneak in there, like, to, you know, fake yourself as a reporter and actually ask them a question. It would never work. You couldn't do that. But it would just be, it's a mental exercise. Wouldn't it be funny? Because he has dementia and he might actually answer it. You know, Mr. President.
Yeah, you, Bill.
It's like, my name's not Bill, but okay. Hey, you said that white supremacists are the number one terrorist threat in America. Could you define who exactly are white supremacists? What does that mean? And in his dementia moment, he said, we just mean white people. All of you white people, remember how I said that when white people replaced as the majority, it was going to be a great thing? I meant you. You sorry bastards need to die.
Lulzy. Lulzy for sure.
Grandpa, thanks for thanks for the particularly blackpilling white people don't want to help episode. I do what I can. I spread all of the pills. You see, I have like a pill box, and it's like, what do you get today? So we're going to just put together some red, some black. You might get a white. I don't know. I listen to so much hopium in these depressing clown world times. A serious bitch slap from someone I respect is needed to put things back in perspective. Very thankful for the non-sugar-coated truth in Christ focused format of your show. You're helping more folks than you'll know. It's so easy to send a little something. I really hope more folks step up. Regards, Jackie. And I really do appreciate it. And again, the focus of the show is always truth. It really is. And it's, I don't really set out to do any of these shows like, you know, hey, I'm going to give everybody an upper. Today's going to be a positive show or today's going to be a depressing show. I just, whatever truths we can focus on that day when I sit down and do the show. That's what we aim for. You know, I mean, it may be an upper, it may be a downer, it may be enlightening, it may be interesting, or you may just find it boring as hell. But the goal of the show is always try to be truth centric. You know, I just try to focus on the truth, because if we focus on the truth, we'll be good. You know, I just really believe that we focus in on the truth. And, you know, that's I feel like that's essentially doing my job. As long as we do that, people agree with it, disagree with it, get something out of it, don't get something out of it. As long as we stay focused on the truth. And if we get it wrong and you say, well, I thought this was correct, but now I see it's not. So we'll correct for that as we rock along. But we do always try to focus on the truth here. So as I say, I guess what I'm saying is the bitch slap was unintentional. I did not intentionally, bitch slap you. So, and our final one, and I say this one for last, because I think it'll be a good jumping off point and something I was going to discuss this week anyway. So here we go. Dear Grandpa Dan. And yes, the first part here is personal stuff. So we're skipping by that. And yes, I got your personal stuff there. And I hope all works out. And yes, prayers have been sent. And I hope you see something amazing. I hope everything works out. And maybe you'll see something miraculous. I hope you really get a blessing from God. And all the things you're going through work out for you. So we're going to go ahead and pick up after the personal personal stuff. And also there's a note in here about wanting to see another round table. Blah, blah, blah. I was already thinking ahead to spend Longshanks and I said long table. Another round table with Dr. Johnson, Sir Longshanks and myself. And we're always trying to get that in the works. It's something we do from time to time. But it's hard to get everybody's schedule together. But at some point in time, you will see another roundtable with Dr. Johnson, Sir Longshanks, and myself. So we will get that done. Okay, so let's get in here. One thing I wanted to comment on is the need to make sure we need to take care of each other and to talk to our friends and family. We have next to no control over the violent mobs that rule the streets, the oligarchs driving the economy into the ground, the media pressure to take the vaccine, or the possibility of a major war. We do have some control over staying in contact with each other and making sure we don't feel alone. Just knowing that people IRL are out there that think the same things help us with being able to resist the social pressures that is used against us or used on us. It's been some dark days and it's going to get darker, but I have been very grateful for your wit and humor. It's been a comfort to me and my family. You have been in my thoughts and prayers as well, your brother in Christ, Mike. And this is really, I say this one for last because this kind of gives me a good jumping off point into the rest of the show. So I'll just pause for a moment and say thank you again, all of you financially helping out. It's really appreciated. This is something, this whole IRL friends and family and people around us, people you work with. This is something I've been harping on quite a bit, and I'm going to harp on it once again today, because I was thinking about this just the other day in the context of, you know, the social media thing is dead. I'm going on now, let's say at the first of the year, January 1st this year, I deleted my Gab account, which was my last social media account in existence. And it was hesitant for a moment. You know, I had quite a few followers and had like 20,000 something posts over the years on there. And now it's all gone. You know, in the click of a button, deleted it. And there was a moment of hesitancy. I believed it was something I should do. I had prayed on it and I believed then, and I believe now, that essentially God was telling me, yeah, you need to get rid of that shit and get that shit out of your life. And so I did it. And I got to tell you, I don't miss it at all. Man, don't get me wrong. You know, a lot of you have found this show through social media. There's nothing wrong with that. But I thought we'd talk a little bit about the pointlessness of chasing after social media. Because social media used to be so effective back when you could actually be on social media. And now you get banned and people wind up either chasing the bans around, you know, creating new accounts. And I'll just reopen another account. Ha ha ha, I'm working around that. Until you get finally, you've chased that as far as you can. So then you wind up in in these internment camp social media, such as Parler, Gab, or whatever these alternate. And yeah, I'll just go ahead and say it once again. I say it time and again. I've got nothing against what those people are trying to create there. I've got, you know, I'm not dissing those platforms at all, but I do find it pointless personally. Find it pointless, and it's pointless to chase after social media. I think at this point in time, as the listener has spelled out here, it's much more imperative that you know people in your life, people you work with, and you can feel people out and discuss things with people, see how far they are with this stuff. And as they get more comfortable, they'll open up to you more and you'll feel more comfortable. You know, don't be going in there like just cramming red pills down their throats, you know, like, ah, you know, they give you a little opening like to discuss, you know, something pretty tame, like, you know, yeah, the Democrats stole the election, for instance. You know, don't go leaping off from there into full on, you know, there were no gas chambers and soap, because they're just going to probably shut down and not listen to you. But it's going to be so important. And what the listener spells out here is so absolutely correct. And this goes to faith. We have no control over these bigger things. As he says here, we've got no control over the oligarchs. We've got no control of the fact that they're headlong diving us into a war that this country is not going to win. The destruction, the economy, the clown world around us, the media shutting us down, everything, you know, we're being demonized. You've got the dementia president of the United States saying that you as a white person are now the number one terrorist threat that the country faces, and they're going to do everything they can to do something about you. You've got these people openly on social media, and their accounts don't get banned, saying we need to quote unquote end whiteness. If that's not some sort of incitement to violence, I don't know what is. It's essentially calling for the genocide of an entire race of people, but that's okay. That's not against the Twitter rules of engagement or whatever. You have no control over those things. You have control over yourself. Social media at this point is a waste of time. It's a waste of time to chase that thing around. Because what happens, you get sucked into the social media thing, and you start chasing likes, you know, and reposts, and you wind up wasting all this time with people that you don't even know. I mean, it's fine. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I haven't met any of you IRL. Maybe someday I will. I hope so. You know, but when the rubber hits the road, when the shit hits the fan, and the shit is coming, the shit is mid-fling. It is flying through the air towards the giant ass fan. We can all see it. Everybody sees. That's why you have this level of stress in the society. You've got people on edge. You've got people that are already losing their shit and doing crazy ass stuff, because on some level or another, people realize the shit is midair heading towards the fan. And when the shit does hit the fan, the people that you know, like around you in your life, are going to be more valuable than a vault full of gold. Is going to be more valuable. People that you can support and do things for, and they can do things for you, and you can kind of help each other get through all of this, is going to be something very, very important. Now, again, don't confuse what we have here with like what I'm talking about social media, because it's two different things. We kind of have a, I don't know, I consider this a congregation, an online congregation. We discuss these things. This is a little more in depth than making a zinger one-liner post on social media, hoping to get a bunch of likes. That's a very shallow thing. I think what we do here is much more important. We've worked hard here at Radio Albion, and I've worked hard with this show as well, to present things now in a way to where perhaps even as you engage people in your personal life, you can, you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, yeah, there's no good talk radio or something, you know, where people could feel comfortable saying, hey, well, Radio Albion, you know, I listen to podcasts on Radio Albion, and the podcasts there are all real good. And we try to present this in a professional way. You know, the days of being outlandish and you know, prodding people around like that are, that's used up now. We try to be presentable. We try to be as professional as possible in what we're presenting, so that you know, so that people can say, hey, you know, you ought to check this out, and they don't feel like, you know, they're engaging in something shady here, because there is nothing shady here. We're all very non-shady people. And you know, to make that more presentable, so that, you know, people can get this information and discuss these things, and perhaps, you know, start to see things that they didn't realize before. You look at the toxic world that is AM conservative talk radio, and I don't listen to that crap, but, you know, I encounter people, I do business in places, and you go into places and they have that on, you know, and they've got the conservative talk radio on, and the little bit you're exposed to it, you're like, oh my gosh. This suit is so obviously geared towards keeping people on the reservation, keep people bought into the system. You just got to vote for more Republicans. Yeah, they totally stole the election, but you got to vote for more Republicans. It's obviously, it's so, and it's sad. It's sad when people hear that and they're telling you about something they heard on AM talk radio and they're trying to tell you, you know, like, oh, wow, it was so amazing. And you listen to this and you just kind of nod your head like, oh, yeah, you know, this stuff is just bottom tier. I mean, it really is. It's bottom tier quality. You take any of the shows, any of the hosts, I'm not boasting, but myself included, any of the hosts here on Radio Albion, and replace these AM talk radio shills with us, I believe we could put up a much more professional program and really be more informative. It's just so obvious that these people, they're shills. Their job is to keep people on the reservation. Their job is to keep people bought into the system. So, yeah, obviously they're never going to put us on AM talk radio. But we are out here. And again, I think what we do here with these shows is something very important. But that's something different from social media. And I'm not saying you've got to go out now. I'm telling you, you've got to go out and delete your social media account. But I'm telling you that when you get banned or you realize that, you know, these things really, it's not the end of the world. In fact, I think your life is better for it. Another thing is, if you're posting Anon and maybe you're still edge posting like it's 2015, here's the thing, you know, they can dox you when they want to, you know, I mean, you know, that's just pretty much a fact. If they so choose, they can dox you on that. And, you know, you have all of these posts. Maybe you have, you know, a whole bunch. Maybe you've been on, say, Gab for 3, 4, 5 years, whatever the case may be. Maybe you've racked up. So you've got 10,000 posts on there you've made here. You know, 10,000 posts since you... Can you say that out of all of those 10,000 posts, do you want 10,000 things that you've said that just sitting there for somebody to sit there and comb through and try to find something so that they could say, oh, look here, and put it out of context and try to get you in trouble? Been there and done that, by the way. You know, the point is that if you need to be Anon, if you need to, you know, to keep your job and support your family, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you really probably need to get off social media. I mean that. You really need to get off social media. We have people now, as a reminder, we know that Twitter will hand people's IP addresses, personal information. We had the whole thing with the leftist that essentially got a law enforcement visit because he actually disagreed with AOC on something. We know that. We've had policemen, teachers, firefighters, paramedics lose their job because they said something that fell afoul of the narrative. You've got people who have been fired because they donated some money to Kyle Rittenhouse's fund, for instance. And how do they know they donated to, well, because the fund got hacked, blah, blah, blah. I would bet, though, that it was traced back to social media. I mean, yeah, sure, they hacked the fund. They said, okay, Joe Blow here, he gave $10 to Kyle Rittenhouse's fund. But who's Joe Blow? Well, I guarantee the first thing they did was go to social media to see who Joe Blow was. Well, Joe Blow was a paramedic, or Joe Blow was a firefighter, or whatever the case may be. That's how they find out who. I mean, yeah, they could go further in if they want to. But I would just be willing to bet that they go to people's social media. That's the first thing they go to. All these people that you hear about now, because now regular Trump supporters are white supremacists. Everybody who is white that is not a part of the anti-white race hating agenda, they're white supremacists. That is something, if you're new around these parts, you've got to get in your head. These terms, they'd say white supremacist, they don't mean you're running around in a clan hood, because nobody is doing that shit. That, I mean, that isn't even a thing. They mean you. They literally have called everybody that went to the Trump rally on January 6th, insurrectionists, terrorists, white supremacists. They do. They mean you. If you are not gung-ho in on the anti-white race-hating agenda, then you are white supremacists. If you're white, you're white. Well, hell, maybe if you're not white. They're calling black people now that aren't all in on the anti-white race-hating agenda, they're white supremacists too. Brown people, Asians, it doesn't matter. You all get to be white supremacists. The point is, the term has no meaning aside from if you're not in, if you're not gung-ho, if you're not willing to be a part and contribute to the anti-white race-hating agenda, then you're a white supremacist. And you may think, hey, I don't host a podcast, or I don't, you know, I'm just this guy. I'm just a cop who's donated some money to Kyle Rittenhouse. if you're on social media, you know, you may be the one. You may be the one to get picked to be made an example out of. You may be the nail that sticks up just enough to get hammered down to try to send a message to everybody else. And that's what it's about. It's about sending a message. But now social media has become an actual weapon to be used against people. I really mean that. I mean, you like posting your truthoids and your factoids. I mean, again, I'm not telling you you can't do that. I'm not telling you not to do that. You make your own decisions. But I am just forewarning you that now social media has kind of run out of gas as far as being useful. It was once useful, you know, when we could interact with the general public and then, you know, confront leftists or whatever the case may be on there. But those days are gone, and you have to accept reality for what it is. Now your social media is just simply something they can fish through if they decide to make an example out of you. Again, that's the reality. I'm just being upfront with you. You have to bear that in mind. And what are you getting out of it? Because more than likely, you've been banned from Twitter. You've been banned from Facebook. So if you still have social media, you're probably on Gab. You're probably on Parler. So your little factoids and your little information, the only people reading that shit are other people that agree with you. That's why you're getting likes and stuff, because it's just other people that have also been banned from those. So you're not really spreading any new information. So you just it's just something to think about. You know, something to kick around in your brain. Anything in the world. In fact, you have more time. But as the listener points out here, I think your energies are much better spent congregating with us here on this show. But also, really build relationships with people around you, be it friends, be it family, be it coworkers. I honestly, honest to goodness, I believe this is going to be one of the most important things you can do in these clown days coming up. I really do. People you can depend on, people that you can trust, people that you, and remember, that always means you've got to do something too. People aren't going to just sit around, you know, waiting for the opportunity to help you out when you need it. You've got to be willing to help other people out. And when you establish a track record of being willing to do that, when your time comes, more than likely people will be willing to step up and help you. It's just the way it works. I mean, you know, if you're never going to be there for somebody else, they aren't going to be there for you. So you got to be willing to do that. But I do think that this is a very important place to be focusing your energies. Hand in hand with this, and I said this, and many others have said it as well, if you can get as far away from the cities as you can, if you can do that, I highly recommend it. Because see, we look at the racial strife that has now just been turned up to level 11, but you have to realize this racial strife is centered in the cities. It is an urban phenomenon. And people have been urbanized, and I've said it so many times, but I really believe this urban lifestyle is something completely unnatural for us as a people. It's unhealthy spiritually, mentally, and even physically. I think it's a very unhealthy way to live, stacked up on top of one another in these cities. But even if you disagree with that, the fact of the matter is the racial strife is in the cities. When you hear of these stories, so for instance, if you live in a rural town, you live in a little country town, more than likely, you know, the black family that has lived there for generations, that has known your family for generations, they're probably not going to hate you. They're probably not going to be all like BLM up in your face and, you know, kill all the white people, because they've known you for generations. You know, some stranger on TV is trying to whip them up into a frenzy to hate white people, but they know you personally. The more rural you are, the more you know people personally, and the harder it is for them to stir up conflict and angst and hatred between two groups. Regardless, I mean, I use the black family that lives in town as an illustration, but whatever the groups may be, it's harder for them to whip up that animosity because you know people personally. If somebody talks shit about, say you've got a friend, you've known this friend since high school, and you've been tight your whole life, and suddenly the stranger comes up and starts telling you what a shithead your friend is, and he's sorry, and why he's done all of these horrible things. You know, more than likely, you're not going to buy all that shit because you know this guy. You know this guy personally. You see, these things are possible in an urban setting because nobody knows each other. Even in the suburbs, people don't know their neighbors. They don't have connections with people that they've had their entire lives, much less connections with families for generations. They all grew up in the same town. These families have known each other for generations. They don't have that connection. They're urbanized, isolated. One of the things I've said before that I find so contradictory and interesting about urban lifestyle is you have people living in concentration like never before. You have people literally stacked on top of one another in these urban settings, and yet they're more isolated than they've ever been. They're more hyper-individualized than they've ever been. People live spread out in a rural area. You live out in the country, you probably know who your neighbor 5 miles down the road is because his cows have gotten out on your place, and you got to call him up and say, well, Jim, your cows are over here. I've got them pinned up for you. You know who Jim is 5 miles away. You live in a city in an apartment. Do you know the person that lives in the apartment 2 doors down? No. In fact, if you approached them and said, hey, I'm so-and-so, I'd like to meet you, you know, I'd get to know you, they're probably going to run in their apartment and shut the door because there's something strange about this. What do y'all want? You must want something. You're a creeper. You use some kind of stalker. I'm calling the police. This hyper individualized setup, yet where people are in a concentrated area. This allows them to stir all this shit up. Don't get me wrong. I'm not sitting here saying, well, if they didn't do that, people wouldn't. Yeah. That what allows them to do it on this level, because you're always going to have some conflict when you have different races living in proximity to one another. That's a natural order of things, the way things work. But what makes this level of bullshit possible is the fact that they've got people in this, you know, living so close to one another, so concentrated, and yet hyper-individualized. People don't know each other. People don't know who each other is. They don't know their family. They don't know, you know, they don't know, well, I've known Tyrone my whole life. I know his daddy. His daddy, he played football here. Yeah, they don't have that connection. And so they can whip this up. They can demonize people right down the road, right next door to them. Your neighbor could be sitting there just hating your guts because they heard you're an awful person because they don't know anything about you. It's just an amazing thing. And these circumstances have had to come together to make this possible. People have been pushed into these urban environments. They're living closer to one another than ever before. You got all these people concentrated together in one area, and yet they're hyper-individualized. They don't know anyone around them. They don't trust anyone around them. They don't trust anything around them. They live in their little apartment. They come out and they go to their little shitty job in the cubicle, and then they go back home and they lock themselves in their apartment, sit on the internet or whatever the case may be. They don't know their neighbor. They don't know the people down the street, much less have they known them their whole lives. The urban lifestyle has allowed them to whip up this level of animosity between people. The urban lifestyle is fake. It's fake. You go out in the country and you walk into a forest full of trees, that's real. Why? Because God created that. That is a creation. You cannot make a tree. You could plant a seed and grow a tree, but you cannot go out there and build a tree. You're not capable. No man is capable of that. God created that. Yet you live in these cities. There are hardly any trees. You're separated from God's creation. Instead, you have all this bullshit that people made, all these buildings, all these roads, all these things that people made, but it's all fake. It's not an actual creation. You understand? They took elements that God made and put them all together to build these. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with building buildings or building a house, whatever the case, but it's fake in the sense that it's not things made by God. So people become so separated. And the fact that you live in this fake world surrounded by these buildings and so far removed from nature, this also makes it easier for them to create this bubble world, this bubble mentality. You see these people. And I honestly, I hate using the left and right terms anymore, and yet we still have to use them. And I say these leftists, but really these anti-white race haters, I don't know. That's such a big mouthful because the terms have become so blurred. But you have these people and they live in this bubble world, completely detached from reality. They can't look at reality, and when confronted with reality, they can't mentally handle it. They have a breakdown when you point reality. They live in this bubble world of women can do anything men can do, and all the races are the same except for the color of the skin, but we need more diversity by having more skin colors, but race doesn't exist. You see all of these contradictions when you look at it from the outside, and it doesn't make any sense. Well, that is because they live in a fake world. They don't live close to nature. I love it when these environmental type people, you know, and don't get me wrong, I'm big about the environment. I don't want to see a bunch of pollution. I don't want to live in polluted shit. Nobody does. But of course, this climate change hoax nonsense is a far cry from actual like caring about the environmentals or the environment. I'm sorry. I love it when these environmentalist type people from the cities, they try to talk about, you know, shit that they know absolutely nothing about. I read a deal some time back and they were lamenting this environmentalist person was lamenting about the poor treatment of cattle. Cattle have it so bad. Oh my gosh. And they were lamenting and they were spouting off about this like they know something about it, which wears you out, you know, because especially if it's something you do know something about. They were lamenting. They said the cows, the mother cow bellows and her calf cries because the people separate the calf from the mother so that they can just milk her, so that they don't allow the calf to have the mother's milk. And that is absolute bullshit. Nobody does that. Do you know what you have when you have a calf that can't nurse a mother? It's called a bottle calf. Now, who in their right mind wants to have to dick around with mixing milk up? And where would the milk come from? It's going to come from another cow. You have to mix milk up and go out there with a bottle and feed the calf to keep it alive. Who in the hell is going to do that when they could just leave the calf with the mama cow and they could nurse the mama cow and you don't have to do anything? Instead, you're going to milk the cow, put it in a bottle, and go feed the calf. It doesn't make any sense. They don't know what the hell they're talking about, but they spout off like they do. The cows lament, and they're kept in these torturous conditions, and they don't even know the difference between beef cattle, dairy cattle. You know, most cows are out in a field somewhere, in a pasture somewhere. You can drive through the country. I read this. You read these people live in the city, don't know a freaking thing about what they're talking about. Going on as though they're experts on the way cattle live, the way cattle are treated. And you go through the country, you drive down some country road, and you look over in this field, and here are these fat, happy cattle all laid up, more food than they can eat, chewing their cud. Their calves are running around bucking with their tails up in the air. And it's like, oh yes, these poor cows, they have such a lamentable life. They have such a horrible, horrible existence, these poor cows. But it's being spouted off by somebody who has no idea. They're so far removed from nature, they don't know anything about it. They live in a fake world surrounded by fake buildings, fake facade, fake people, fake jobs, not really doing anything. They're just moving numbers around on a computer or shuffling paperwork. They don't actually create or build anything. They have these fake lies and this fake bubble. And then they try to look out there and talk about reality as if they know what it is. But they don't. The things that you see around you today in this clown world shithole of a nation are only made possible to this extent because people were pushed into the cities. It's because of urban life. That is the key ingredient. Yes, they mixed other things into the recipe, but the base ingredient, the dough to start with, the base ingredient to start with, you know, because like you cook up a recipe and you have this main thing, this is the main ingredient, but then you add your spices and your other things to flavor it up a bit. The main ingredient here that is possible for all of this is people living in the cities, this urban lifestyle. Now, I mean, your situation may be that you can't leave the city, and I'm sorry, because things are going to get shitty for you sooner probably rather than later. You know, I mean, the reality is what it is, but as I said before, we always seek to just, you know, we're truth-centered here. You know, not happy pill-centered, not I've got good news for you. If we have good news, we share that, but we do try to focus on truth and focus on reality. All of this is made possible. None of the things they're pushing right now could be done if people lived in the city. People lived in the country, if people were rural, if people were not in the city. Can you imagine? Can you imagine your little small town? You live in a town of 6,000 people and you go to your local Boy Scout lodge to cast your paper vote because, you know, country towns don't hardly dick with the electronic voting machines. And you go down to the paper vote and to cast your ballot for president, and some stranger shows up and says, you all got to leave. We've got these boxes full of ballots we're going to add in here. It wouldn't happen. Because people running the polling station are local people. They're like, who are you? Get the hell out of here. Run you out of town on a rail, maybe with some tar and feathers on you. See, like the voter fraud. They wouldn't be able to do that in a small town because everybody knows each other. People running the polling station know the people coming in to vote. Some outsider isn't going to show up and throw everybody out and put boards up on the windows so that they can bring in new votes. That's not going to happen. See, all of these things are made possible because nobody knows each other. This urban lifestyle is what makes it all possible. Now, I wanted to hit on one more thing. We got to get into our Christian-specific segment, but I had one thing I had jotted down, an observation, because I go around, I talk to working people, I deal with working people on a daily basis. I talk to people in different fields and in different, you know, different areas. And then I'm going to tell you something I've observed here the past couple of weeks. There's something going on. Well, duh, there's a lot of shit going on. But no, there's something going on. And in that, I'm hearing from people in completely unrelated fields, you know, whether it's automotive fields or whether you're talking about equipment fields or whatever the case may be. And I'm hearing the same thing. Can't get parts. Can't get this. Can't get that. Oh, there's a shortage of this. There's a shortage of that. And these are in completely unrelated fields. And I've talked to quite a few people. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. I'm hearing the same thing. Oh, well, I can't get those because when I call my supplier, they say, well, there's a shortage right now. They can't get this. They can't get that. There's something going on with all this. And again, these are all incomplete things that have nothing to do with one another. Completely isolated. It doesn't matter. I'm hearing the same thing. Can't get it. Can't get it. Can't get it. There's a shortage. Something going on. Now, my hunch on this, I have no way to prove it. I have a way to know it for sure. But my hunch on this is the clown world government, you know, shipped all the manufacturing to China. And now they're in the process of talking hella shit, rattling the sabers of war against China. And I'm thinking that China is just basically like, okay, well, we're just going to dial back what you're getting from us that we're manufacturing because they can sell it to whoever in the world that isn't like antagonizing and trying to create a situation of conflict with them, you know, because they don't have to have, well, you know, we'll just make $1 billion on this instead of 2 billion. We're still good. You know, I suspect that China is not really appreciative of the of this constant antagonizing, and they're dialing back with their shipping. And that's why all of these different areas are seeing shortages and availability of parts. That's my hunch. I haven't, like I said, I don't have any proof of it, but that's what makes the most sense to me. The most, you know, sensible, common sense answer, the simplest answer is probably right. And I suspect that when you've got this government that after years ago and over the years, shipping all the manufacturing to China is now in the process of constantly antagonizing, demonizing, and essentially threatening war with China. And so they're like, well, yeah, we don't really see a reason to start, you know, to keep shipping you there. Here, we're going to dial back your supplies. Enjoy that. And it's something to be just be done quietly. They won't have to make an announcement. Just people can't get anything anymore. You have a part shortage now. You can't get things anymore. I suspect that's what's going on. But I just thought I wanted to shoehorn that in there. I had that in an observation. And again, if you live in a city and you just have an office job, and you know, you're probably not aware of this thing. But it's something I've observed. I've talked to enough people now that are giving me the same story. There's something going on with this. So you've got diplomats from Russia, diplomats from China being thrown out here, thrown out there. The constant antagonizers push for war with Russia and China. And I think it may be worse and further along than what we even think it is. We're pretty aware of it, but I think it may, you know, things may be going further down that road than we think. I don't know. It's all speculation. But anyway, we need to wrap up the regular portion of the show. We need to get into the Christian specific segment, the sermon, if you would, this week, at the Parish of the Patriots. So you know what to do. Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's Christian-specific talk here at the Parish of the Patriots. So as you get settled in here for this week's sermon here, I always hope that we have something here that means something. That's always the goal here, is just to, you know, hopefully we'll put something together and have a discussion that can impact you, you know, and help you as you navigate your way through these weird, perilous clown world times. And this week, I thought we'd discuss a little bit, because I have this belief that as a Christian believer, at some point in time, every one of you, every Christian believer has the opportunity to, in some form or another, encounter God. I mean, it might not be, I'm not saying you're going to have a, you know, Paul and the blinding light and scales from your eyes sort of like literal encounter, but I believe you can. I believe you can encounter God. You can see his hand in that, you can see his hand at work in your life. And it might be something that will come about that nobody could have predicted, but it's at the right time. It's essentially like a miracle, and you might have that, but it might be something more subtle. You might have something come around and you think there's no way, like for instance, you can meet your budget, and then just like multiplication of the bread and fishes, you know, you get done paying your bills and you somehow did it, and you're not really sure how that even worked out. And I think it's important to recognize and look for those things and give God credit when you believe those things. And you might think to yourself, but what if I'm wrong? But what's wrong with, you know, praising the Lord and giving him credit, even if maybe it is something that happened by happenstance? You know, likewise, on the flip side of that, you shouldn't be, you know, ridiculous about it. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I found this thing here just laying on the, you know, that I've been looking for. Oh, there it happens to be. Now I remember where I left it. Thank you, Jesus. I mean, now I'm not saying to be absurd about it, but the point here is I do think that it is possible, if you look hard enough and have your heart right, you know, to at least observe and in a way encounter God in your life if you're looking for it. And that's a good thing, because it strengthens your faith and helps you on your journey. But likewise, I think it's also very quite possible, and I will even say likely, that on your walk in life, as you navigate your way through clown world, that you're also going to encounter Satan. In fact, as a Christian believer, you're going to encounter Satan. Now, I'm not saying you're going to have some exorcist or some movie encounter with Satan, because it doesn't work like that anyway. You know, you're not going to like wake up from your sleep and there's a shadow hanging over you, you know, I'm going to get you, or something. So, yeah, I hate the Hollywood version of how Satan and demons work, because it doesn't, that's so inaccurate. You know, Satan dresses himself up is really nice. And a lot of times Satan will dress his messengers up in the clothes of one of your friends, of one of your acquaintances, maybe even a family member. We're going to get into that a little bit about recognizing when you're, you know, because and when you encounter somebody that's acting as a messenger of Satan, understand this: they're not even necessarily trying to do that. They're not even, you know, they're not, it's not something they're consciously doing, but it's something, because their heart isn't right, they get manipulated into acting as a messenger of Satan. I was just thinking of you know, when I believe it was Peter told Jesus, well, you know, we're not going to let you, you know, we'll keep them from crucifying you. And Jesus is like, get behind me, Satan. You know, I mean, it was like literally a rebuke. And we know that Peter wasn't like working for Satan, but in that moment, he was acting as a messenger of Satan. And Jesus recognized that. So, I mean, and it wasn't anything against Peter. I mean, Peter went on to do great things, but understand that you can have people that just, because the circumstances are right, they will act as a messenger of Satan, and thus you will wind up basically encountering Satan. I thought we'd also, in this discussion, we'd look a little bit about how becoming obsessed with things, which is essentially covetousness, how that works and how destructive it is, and how it just essentially blinds you to every other option out there, and how something you think you want, and it winds up being that you don't want that. So we're going to get into all of that. And of course, we'll go ahead and start off. We're going to take this lesson, obviously. We're going to open our Bibles up this week, and we're going to kind of jump around with the story, but I like this story, and I think it's really illustrative. And you get into our Old Testament, and so many of these things, you have to realize human nature doesn't change. And because human nature doesn't change, you read these things that happened then, and they apply now. They apply to you. Is it applied to them? As it applies to people around you? Because again, human nature doesn't change over the years. Now, we're looking in 2 Samuel chapter 13, and I'm going to forewarn you, wait a minute, I'm not going to read the whole chapter, because the whole story takes up the whole chapter. You're welcome to read the entire story. So if we're going to kind of skip along here, just to be as brief as possible so we can fit all of this together in the time we've got. And as I always say every week, you know, if I sit here and just read, it's going to put everybody to sleep, and we're not going to get to the points that we want to make. And that is our ultimate goal. We have points that we want to make here. So bear with me through this, and we're going to walk through this story of 2 Samuel chapter 13. Hopefully I don't get these names. I always hate, you know, pronouncing these Old Testament names. So if I screw those up, it's not going to take away from the story. And it came to pass after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. And Amnon was so vexed that he fell sick for his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and Amnon thought it hard for him to do anything to her. Now, you have to remember the king has all these wives, and so you have all these half-brothers, half-sisters, and everything, and they're all essentially living in close proximity to one another. And it's not an uncommon thing, I suppose, for half-brothers and half-sisters to have a thing here. But so we have our story here. We've already set the stage here. Amnon is just he's literally making himself sick because he wants this woman so bad. This Tamar. He's just all he can think about. I mean, he's obsessed with her. It says he loved her. But we're going to find out he didn't actually love her. He was obsessed with her. He was lusting after her. And he was to the point of it was eating him up. It was covetousness gone wild, as it were. And that'll become more apparent. So let's keep on rocking. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab. The son of Shimei, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very subtle man. And he said unto him, "Why art thou, being the king's son, lean from day to day? Wilt thou not tell me?" And Amnon said unto him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." And Jonadab said unto him, "Lay thee down on thy bed, and make thyself sick. And when thy father cometh to see thee, say unto him, I pray thee, let my sister Tamar come, and give me meat, and dress the meat in my sight, that I may see it, and eat it in her hand." So Amnon lay down and made himself sick. And when the king was come unto him, Amnon said unto the king, "I pray thee, let Tamar my sister come and make me a couple of cakes in my sight, that I may eat at her hand." Now, Amnon just met the snake in the garden in the form of Jonadab. He just encountered Satan, because he's just dying to know what's wrong with you. Oh, hey, what's wrong? What's going on? Oh, now, Jonadab could have told him, you know, there's a way you can go about this, and we'll get into that here in a minute. He could have counseled him wisely, but what does he do? He comes up with a scheme that Amnon is just also anxious, also ready to jump into as he's consumed by his covetousness and his lustfulness. Why, he cooks up the scheme. Look, all you got to do, you already just make yourself sick, lay in the bed, and then convince the king that you just want her to come, make some cake. You know, he doesn't tell him. Then when she gets there, rape her. But he's setting the stage, you see. You could still have that justification. Oh, I'll feel better if she comes and makes some cakes with her own hand. I can imagine Amnon was sitting there, I won't just force her, but she'll be there and it'll be nice. And all he can see is his own lustfulness, which he has misplaced as love. But the point here is Amnon now has had an encounter with Satan in the form of Jonadab. The snake, I mean, this just, the language that is used here, it's the snake in the garden all over again. Here, what's wrong? I just want to know what's wrong. Oh, look here. Here's a scheme you can do. Not the right way you can do it. Not to rebuke him of covetousness. Not of telling him, man, you need to get yourself straight here, you know. He comes up with a scheme. Look, and Amnon's all too anxious to fall right into the scheme. Why? Because he's blinded. He's blinded by his covetousness and his lust. He can't think straight. He's not thinking straight. All he can think about is what he wants. He wants it right now. He's got to have it. He's telling himself he loves her. But as we'll get into this, we'll find out that he does not actually love her at all. So now the stage is set. He's had his encounter with Satan. The snake in the garden has showed up and given him this counsel, and he's followed through with this scheme. The scheme works out. We're going to skip forward. We're going to start again here at verse 11. Like I said, I'm going to kind of move along here. So she shows up to make the cakes, and he keeps prodding. Well, have her come in here. Well, now I want her to feed them, because she's saying outside. She's make the cakes out here. Okay, I made these cakes. You know, here you go. Whatever. But he keeps on prodding. No. Have her come in here. And then when she comes in, he sends everybody out of the room. Now he's committed himself. You see, he took that next step. He could have stopped. He could have stopped and said, okay, wait a minute. I've had her make the cakes for me, you know, okay. But you see, now another step. He went through the first step of the plan. These things don't just happen out of the blue. When you get ate up by the sin, it doesn't just happen like, oh, all of a sudden this just happened. And people say that. People try to justify things and say, well, it just happened out of the blue. But when you really look at it critically, there was decision. There was step by step. He went through with the plan. He had, you know, had her come back to Kate. Then he has her come in and feed him to him. And then he sends everybody out of the room. And we'll pick up here, I think, at verse 11. And when she had brought them unto him to eat, he took hold of her and said unto her, come lie with me, my sister. And she answered him, nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly. And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And we've discussed this before about how things worked in those days. I mean, a woman, her value was, you know, as long as she was a virgin, when she had sex, she became somebody's wife. She had to become a wife. Otherwise, she was tainted. Otherwise, she essentially, it ruined her entire life. You cannot compare those times to this times. You know, this was a huge deal. If she lost that, then she would not be able to find a husband. And that meant a future for her. Again, and she answered him, nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly, and I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? In other words, this is going to ruin my life. She's trying to reason with him. She's saying, look, you're fixing to ruin my life. No, do not force me to do this. And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. And she's saying, look, this is going to destroy you too. It's not just me. Look, don't do this. You're going to ruin yourself as well. And again, he has the choice here. He could stop here. You know, he hasn't actually done it. He's pushed it to the line, and there could be conflict over this. But at the end of the day, he has his choice. Stop now. Now, therefore, I pray thee, she's continuing to speak. Now, for I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee. She's pointing out to him, look, go to the king and tell him you want me as your wife, and he'll probably give me to you. Again, you have to get over the fact that these are half brothers and sisters here, because that's kind of creepy by our own view. But this is the way things work. This is a different time, so we can't get hung up on that. The point you do need to get here from this is he can have her. He's been going through this whole vexation. He's been going through this whole ordeal, being consumed with lust over her. And she's pointing out to him, look, you can have me. There is a procedure here. Go to the king and say, look, I want to take her as my wife. And she's saying, look, he's probably going to give me to you. You don't even have to do this. But he's blind today. He does it because it isn't even about that. Here's where we start to really see that it's not even about wanting to have her. I said early on, it says at the very beginning of this that he loved her. But we find out really quick here as the story progresses that he doesn't love her. He's consumed with her. He's obsessed with her. He's lusting after her. He's coveting to the extreme after her. But it's not love. None of these things are love. He's now been consumed by sin. He needed a little prodding from Satan. He was back there where he was just, vexing and sitting around, moaning and sighing over it and thinking about it to the point that he was losing weight. He was trying to work it out. He was perfectly primed. He just had to have that encounter with Satan to prod him a little bit, to get him going in the right direction, which, of course, is the wrong direction. But nonetheless, he just needed this prod. Now, he could have her. All he had to do, he had to follow the procedures. He said, look, go to the king. But see, it's not about that. It's the covetousness. It was about taking it. It was about grabbing hold of it and taking it. Didn't love her. Let's continue on. In verse 14, where she's already told him, look, you could just go to the king and say you want me as a wife. Because she just is trying to avoid her life being ruined. He set aside this ridiculous modern notion of romance. Where's the romance? It's not. It was a very more real times back then. She's trying to establish her future. And she's like, okay, look, I mean, she could do worse than marrying one of the princes. And, you know, then her life won't be ruined. She'll be established. She can move forward. She won't be covered in shame the rest of her life. Her life won't be ruined. And she's trying, by extension of that, she's trying to save him from ruin. And mostly she's trying to save herself. But at the same time, she's pointing out, you're going to ruin yourself with this. But it doesn't matter. How be it, we'll pick up here at verse 14. How be it, he would not hearken unto her voice, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. Now, the term rape in our modern culture has been, like every other word, it's been abused to death and redefined. It's spelled out very clearly here. He forced her and lay with her. And you have to, you know, I'm not trying to be graphic or, you know, sensational here, but you understand this was rape, which means that he beat her to the point she couldn't resist. He forced her meant she resisted. And so he beat her into submission to where she couldn't resist any longer. I mean, this isn't, you know, okay, she went ahead and went along with it, but then she felt bad afterwards. And then, you know, this was rape, which meant he beat her into submission and raped her. Now, this is kind of, we're getting into the wrap up part. We're going to continue on here with verse 15. So now he's forced her. He got what he thought he wanted. Remember, he loved her. He loved her so much. He was losing weight just thinking about her. He just had to have her so much. And he was just there. And it was because he loved her so much. And he just really wanted to make her happy. And he just loved her so much. He loved her so much that he was open up to this plan to trick her into coming into the room where he wound up beating her so she couldn't resist anymore and raping her. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. And Amnon said unto her, Arise and be gone. And she said unto him, There is no cause. This evil in sending me away is greater than the other that thou didst unto me. But he would not hearken unto her. Then he called his servant that ministered unto him and said, Put now this woman out from me. And bolt the door after her. She says, the shame you've done and putting me out. Because he could actually, she's like, okay, you could go ahead and take responsibility here and then make me a wife. Because now the die is cast. You've done this thing. But now he threw her out. He said, no, I'm not going to take responsibility. Not going to make you a wife. Now you're just ruined. And she says, this is an even greater evil that you have done than the rape itself. But the part I want to focus in on here is that he does this. He was so focused, so obsessed with her. But then once he did the deed, he hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he loved her. And again, he didn't love her. That's clear from her illustration. He was obsessed with her. He was lusting. He was covetousness of her. But if it was love, he could have just gone to the king and said, man, I really love her. You know, king, let me take her as wife. And the king would have more than likely said, sure, why not? But see, once he got it, just had to have her. Just once he did all of these things and got her immediately, and not just like he resented her later, he hated her. He hated all of that obsession, all of that covetousness. And when it was all said and done, he hated her more than he lusted after her from the beginning. Now, you can go on and read the rest of the story. I'll go ahead and give you spoilers. At the end of the day, this guy gets murdered over this. Revenge. Her brother takes revenge on him and he gets murdered. You can go ahead and read the rest of the story. Like I said, it's not a real long story. You can finish the chapter again. I don't want to bore you, though, by sitting here and just droning on and reading. We're trying to get to points that mean something to you today, but you're encouraged to read the entire thing. The point is, though, he's so obsessed. He's so ate up. He's so covetousness. Ate up with covetousness, I should say, over her. But then as soon as he gets her, is he goes through all of this nonsense. But as soon as he gets what he thinks he wants, now he hates her. He hates her more than he lusted after her from the beginning. I think it's interesting that it says that, you know, he wanted her so much and he was just so obsessed with her. But yet he wasn't. There's a clue, I guess you could say. There's a clue at the beginning and through this story as you look at it that he didn't really love her and he really didn't even want her. It was just the idea that he could take her. It made him feel powerful. He was blinded by his own desires. He was blinded by his own lusts. Because again, there was a way he could have, if he actually just simply, well, there was a procedure he could go through. He goes to the king and he says, hey, king, you know, I really, you know, and he was of the age, king, yeah, you need a wife, sure, keep it in the family. This all seems weird to us, but it wasn't weird for them. And you know, we just have to roll with that. But he could have followed the procedure, but it wasn't even about all of that. He lusted after, when he finally got her, he hated her and essentially ruined her life, and her warning to him proved true. Again, he winds up at the end of the story, he winds up being murdered as revenge over this. So he ruins himself and he ruins her. And why? Because he was so obsessed. Look, there's nothing wrong with wanting things in life. There is. I mean, I'm one of those people. I tend to always have to have like goals, things I want to do, things I want to accomplish, things to keep me going. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you don't want them to consume you. Because when they consume you, when you get to where it crosses that line into covetousness, because once you do that, if you allow that to happen, you're more than likely going to get an encounter with Satan. Just to give you that little prod, this guy was all set. He was primed. He was ready. He was agonizing and losing weight because, honestly, he was trying to figure out some way to make that happen. Not the right way. You know, the obvious steps to take was go to the king and say, hey, can I have her as his wife? But he didn't want to do that. He was just obsessed with her. And then once he had her, he didn't want her. He hated her exceedingly. It was just about getting off on the high that he could take her, ruin her life. But when you get ate up with something, you're lining yourself. When you cross that line into covetousness, you set yourself up for an encounter with Satan. And he's probably going to be dressed up as your friend. Oh, I'm just worried about you. What's wrong? Now, his friend, supposed friend, could have told him, hey, well, look, dude, you know, I'll go with you if you're worried, you know, if you're nervous, I'll go with you. We'll go to the king. We'll go to the king together and ask the king to make her your wife. But he didn't do that. He didn't give him sound counsel. If he was a friend, he would have given him sound counsel. He just said, look, I'll go with you. There's a procedure here. If you really want her, then we'll go to the king. You can ask the king. You know, we'll do this the right way. But he didn't do that. You see, he had his encounter with Satan. He was filling the role. He was wearing the clothes of Satan's messenger. Again, he wasn't sitting around consulting with Satan. You know, what do you want me to do now, master? But he just fell right into that role. And then said, well, here's your scheme. Here's what you got to do. He needed that little prodding. Just go ahead and do it. He just needed to hear it from somebody else. When you take counsel from somebody, whether it's friend or family, and their counsel is just to go ahead and prod you into that. The only thing holding him back, there was something in him saying, man, you know there's going to be fallout from this. He wants to go do this. He was wanting to go do this very thing. Because if he didn't, when the messenger of Satan showed up and said, hey, you know, set up this plot, which is obviously to set up a scenario where he could rape her, he would have been like, whoa, 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 bro, no, it's not like that. See, but he didn't do that. So his whole agonizing thing that we read about in the beginning, to the point where he was losing weight as he was obsessing over this woman, it was that he was having that struggle inside, that he really wanted to go do this. But there was still that voice in there going, man, you know, you really shouldn't, you know. So then he just needed that little prodding from a quote unquote friend. Yeah, just we'll set up this situation. Look, we'll set up a situation where you can do this. Like I said, he could have said, well, look here, man, you got to go to the king. And if the king says no, you got to accept that. And you got to move on. You know, that would be a real friend. That's how you can tell the counsel of a real friend from the counsel of Satan when somebody's wearing the clothes of the messenger of Satan. When they set up a little scheme to push you on over. He just needed that next little nudge. Satan seen that. He just needed that next little nudge to go ahead and push him on down over the cliff. And each step of the way of that plan, he could have stopped when she was outside and made the cakes and sent them in. He could have said, man, I can't do this. I'm not going to beat and rape this bitch. I just eat the cakes. What am I doing here? I just eat the cakes and say, thank you very much. I'm good now. And then here in a couple days, I'll go to the king and ask him to make her my wife. He didn't do that. He went through with the entire plan and in the end destroyed himself and destroyed her in the process. She was a victim here. Yeah, I hate that. You know, again, the word victim has been abused to death in our modern society, but she was literally a victim here. You have to understand, because he took her and didn't make her a wife, he ruined her for the rest of her life. She basically couldn't get married now. You know, she was still one of the king's daughters, so she more than likely wasn't destined to live in poverty, but she was destined to have no children, destined not to be somebody's wife. Her life was ruined. She was tainted. So we get in here, and we need to go ahead and wrap this up. There's nothing wrong with having things you want in life. You know, I mean, you should have goals. You should have things you want. But you always have to be on your guard, not to cross that line into covetousness. You got to be careful because, and if you do slip into that, recognize you're going to be having that struggle. You'll be having that struggle about, should I? You already know the answer. You already know you shouldn't do what it is you're thinking about doing. You already know that, but you're struggling with that. Beware. Very likely you're going to get an encounter with Satan. Probably going to be in the form of a quote-unquote friend or maybe even a family member. They'll be wearing the clothes. And it's not, like I say, it's not like them personally, but they're just filling that role at the time. And you'll know it when they prod you in to just give you that little nudge right over the line. Your best bet here is to stay away from getting to that point in the first place. You see, the messenger Satan isn't going to show up too early. He's going to show up at right the right amount of time, right at the perfect timing to try to nudge you into on going over the cliff and destroying yourself and possibly destroying those around you, ruining your life. You need to be aware of this. It starts with the covetousness. If you just think, there's, like I said, there's nothing wrong with having things you want, goals you want, whatever the case may be. But when you cross that line to where it's consuming your life, where that's all you think of, you can't hardly eat, that's what you think of, you've crossed the line. And you need to be aware that you've crossed the line. You start getting that crap lined out. You start lining your shit up and realize you've crossed the line into covetousness and you need to repent of that, which means you need to get rid of that. You need to put that back in its place. Again, it may be nothing wrong with that which you seek, but you've allowed it to cross the line of eating you up. You've allowed it to cross the line into obsession. You've got to put that back in its place. You got to get it back in order, where, and by in order, I mean where it's, if you achieve it, great, but if you don't, you have another plan. You have something else you can go do, or you can be satisfied with where you're at now and move on. If you can't do that, if you can't picture your life without that thing that you are now consumed with, that you are now obsessed with, you have crossed that line. There's always another way. There's always another path. There's always somewhere else you can go, another thing you can seek, another thing you can do. And you have to keep that in that right perspective, because if you don't, once you get ate up, once you cross that line into obsession, and it's something you think about 24/7, you are setting yourself up. At some point in time in your struggle, you're going to get a messenger of Satan show up, and he's going to give you that nudge. And once you take that nudge, once you start going down that road, it's very hard to stop. It's very hard to come back from. And in the end, if it followed through to its completion, you could very well ruin yourself and those around you. Anyway, read the whole story. We've kind of discussed at the point, you kind of keep these points in the back of your mind as you read it. And I think this story of what happened could, hopefully mean something to you. Like I say, it's not a long story. It's just the one chapter long, but it is worth reading through the entire thing. We're going to wrap up on that note. I thank you once again, those of you. Don't be shy. Pay those tithes. I do appreciate the financial support. And I do appreciate all of you stopping by for this week's show here at the Parish of the Patriots. We'll be back. I wasn't on Friday with Sir Longshanks. We had some things come up, so didn't get a daily nationalist in, but we usually do get together on Fridays for the daily nationalist show, so be sure and check that out as well. And be sure and check us out next week right here for the Parish of the Patriots.